Let's see what the stew has in store for us today.
Welcome to the Gnomecast, a Gnome Stew's tabletop gaming advice podcast. Here we talk with the other gnomes about gaming things to avoid becoming part of the stew, so I guess we'd better be good. This episode is brought to you by our awesome Patreon backers like the extravagant Erica Bond Barbara Gris, the dashing Daniel Marquid, and the daring Dungeon Masters Block. Today we have myself, Ange, along with Chris and Tomas, and we are going to talk about running mysteries. Before we dive into that main topic, though, we're going to ask our Get to Know a Gnome question. What was a time you saw players fixate on something that was completely out of left field for the game that was being run? Tell us about your red herrings. Chris, I'm going to start with you.
Well, this is a Chris Clone 70. Ange threw me in the stew pot before we started because of something I did on Thaka with advantage, apparently. Sorry about that, Chris 69. Red herrings. Okay. I don't really have a real answer to this question, but the closest I can come to was when I was running my 4E campaign like 20 years ago. That's right. That was like 20 years ago now, folks. Maybe it was 15. Anyways, the characters were in a pretty extensive dungeon that I didn't really intend them to see every room in. Like, I made like a video game dungeon that you didn't have to 100% until one of them unilaterally said, "We're going to 100% this place." So they proceeded to 100% the place and even found the secret Shadow Dragon boss. That's right, I had a Shadow Dragon boss in there because it's Dungeons & Dragons. They were only like 6th level, but, you know, don't skimp on the dragons, people. It was cool because only half of them were at 0 hit points when that fight was over. Not really a red herring, but not what I was expecting.
That is funny. And don't hurt me like that, like saying that 4th edition was 20 years ago, because I know it's close.
It's fine.
We don't talk about that. Okay. As for me, about red herrings, I don't usually like to be the one to leave the red herrings in the story, but the moments that the players grab onto something and transform it into a red herring of some sort that they like to pursue, and the mystery is the other way around, it's always like a very fun time for me. I like to tell sometimes of a player I have or had in a 6-year campaign I had on D&D that there was a very long story that we were going through, a very homebrew one I was running, and I just like to lay some sort of ideas here and there from cool things I found in the Forgotten Realms and other settings. And there was this sort of Cult of the Dragon that exists in the Forgotten Realms. For that very reason, I liked to play with the idea that there was some sort of multiverse going on, and there was a book about the cults of the dragon that they were able to find. There was not much for reason for it to be there, but that started to get one of my players' cogs in their head running and running. And because they couldn't find what to do next at some moments, even though I was trying to lean them into one direction, this guy did the whole conspiracy theorist thing and created like a whole flowchart with thousands of different blocks with different mysteries happening in the campaign. I am not joking, it's huge. It has about 100 different blocks of things going on in the campaign. They were all interconnected in different ways, and he liked to just be there and try to get new things into the chalkboard. For some reason, he connected some dots, and that book in particular led him to believe that Tiamat was one of the big bad evil guys of the campaign. And that couldn't have been farther from the truth. Just because there was also some sort of storyline with some devils that they could find in Avernus, and Tiamat was in Avernus, so he laid some connection there with the red, as a, some sort of red herring that I wasn't even the one laying. And I had a lot of fun with him in particular pursuing that thing that led absolutely nowhere.
Well, you know, you never, GMs never need to add red herrings to a game.
Mm-hmm.
The players will make them.
Exactly. And they are great at that.
Yeah, and mine was something like that as well. This was the very first campaign I ever ran. It was a Mutants and Masterminds Supers game. The spark of an idea I had is I wanted the players at some fancy party in the penthouse of a skyscraper, and I wanted pirates to show up in a flying pirate ship. This was like the elevator pitch of the idea in my head that I wanted to have.
Very cool.
And I started like setting up the encounter, and like offhand, I'm like, what's something that can, you know, I need another like lieutenant or type of character to like work with the pirate captain. And I'm like, you know what? He's got a telepathic talking monkey. And like the idea in my head was that the pirate was actually a Hollywood special effects guru who kind of just went off the deep end when he found this old pirate cache and decided to become a pirate, made his flying ship and went off. And the monkey was just an escapee from a lab that was experimenting on animals. Well, we go through the whole fight. You know, there's a scene, the telepathic monkey gets away. They catch the captain. They get him arrested. My players now have a flying pirate ship, and I don't know what to do with that because I was a brand new GM. But one of my players was like, I know what's happening here. And he started spinning this tale that I had no idea where he got any of this from. But he was convinced that this was the truth, that long ago, there was a pirate captain who got cursed, and his soul ended up in the body of a monkey. And for the last 300 years, he's been basically hopping bodies between the monkeys along the way. And when the special effects guru showed up to scout out this location for some pirate movie he was working on, the monkey, i.e. the pirate captain's soul, saw an opportunity and switched his brain into the special effect guy's head, and the monkey was now the special effects guy. And I'm like, I have no idea where any of this came from, but to my players, that kind of became gospel.
I've heard this story before, but it's still good.
The funny thing is the monkey became a recurring villain in the campaign.
No joke.
Yeah, man, like, that whole idea is great. Like, the idea of the special effects guy that became a pirate on a flying pirate ship with a psychic monkey that escaped from, like, a Project Ultra Wide or whatever it's called. The mind blow people up people. Like, it's such a good idea. Like, you just put that in your back pocket and never get rid of it. Like, you just bring it back every, like, 2 or 3 years.
Absolutely. Yeah, the players will always come up with the wackiest stuff that you will never come up with on your own.
Oh, yeah. So moving on into our main topic, many of our games involve situations that the players figure out over the course of the game or the campaign. But despite that foundational aspect of RPGs, running mysteries can be hard. We decided to get together and talk about some of the issues with running mysteries and some advice on how to make it easier and enjoyable for you and everyone at the table. So first off, we're going to ask, let's talk about mysteries. What is your definition of a mystery in an RPG? Chris?
So I went to Webster's, and then I cobbled together a definition based on some of the Webster's ones and what role-playing games actually are. And I came up with a situation dealing with a puzzling crime, event, or series of events. Many of these revolve around murders or deaths.
Do you have anything to add to that, Tomas?
I'm not sure if they mostly deal with murder or death, but if you want to go that route, that's a possibility, yeah.
I think it depends on the type of mystery you're dealing with, because a murder mystery is obviously a very common concept. I think in general, like, I consider mysteries any sort of investigation where the players and their characters are trying to learn the source of a variety of situations. You know, whether that is a murder and they're trying to find who killed them, or they're trying to find out why is this weird thing happening, you know, and they're investigating further. So murder mysteries are common, but they don't have to be the only type of mystery you're running.
I definitely agree right there. And I'd like to add as well that mystery of any sort is like making your adventure one big puzzle that the players have to solve. And not only the players, because the NPCs might be trying to solve the mystery as well, and that can add more tension or drama to your own story. I don't know if you have any sort of opinion to add to that, Chris.
Yeah, the reason it only sometimes or mostly revolves around murders or deaths is because I grew up watching a lot of Scooby-Doo, and there's nobody getting murdered in that show, and they're just all mysteries.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was thinking, like, I run a lot of Tales from the Loop, and they're always some sort of mystery, but I'm dealing with middle schoolers on bikes in the 1980s, there is not really a whole lot of murder there.
There can be.
There's one that's a murder mystery.
There can be if it's a horror, if it's a straight up horror, yeah.
I think absolutely. There's one that's like, one of my adventures is like a 45-year-old murder mystery. But besides that, so why do so many GMs struggle with running mysteries? What are the roadblocks?
You should let somebody else go first, because I have like a laundry list of things to say about this.
Okay. I have some stuff to say there as well. The fact with mysteries is that they usually have only one right answer. There are games that do it differently, but if you are getting into that sort of boat, you need to try to find a way in which you run the game in some certain way in which the players get to find all clues and you're not railroading them as much, so they feel like they are the ones solving the mystery and having that aha moment. If you are just feeding them the clues right there on their mouths and telling them, hey, this is the solution, they will not have as much fun as if you are just giving them just enough information to connect the dots and reveal them really themselves.
Yeah, I think one of the major problems that often happens, and this can happen in any flavor of game that a GM is running, but what often seems completely obvious to a GM may not be obvious to their players. I've seen this cause so many problems in games where the GM is just like, I don't understand why they don't get it. And it's like, it's because it makes perfect sense to you and the knowledge you have, but your players don't have that same knowledge base. So what you think is completely obvious is completely going over their heads. And it can take a while to figure out how to adjust your ideas to make them available for the players, I think.
Yeah, it's easy when you know the answer to connect the dots there.
Oh, yeah. I am always worried I am so obvious that, like, you know, the solution is completely right in front of the players. And it's like, no, usually it's because it's completely obvious to me is because I know what has been put in place.
Yeah.
You know, and you need to be able to adapt to get your players to the destination, so to speak.
Uh-huh.
Chris, you want to start on your list?
Sure. So the question is, why do many GMs struggle with running mysteries and what are the roadblocks there? So one, as a culture of RPG players, like the overarching culture, the wider culture of role-playing game players, we always tell people to not run railroads, which often gets lumped in with linear adventure structure. And those two things are not the same.
Nope.
So people try to make these things, these mysteries, too open, which many mysteries should probably have a linear adventure structure. Many, not mm-hmm. all, many. And there's not enough through line in them. So people just get lost in the woods and game masters don't know how to direct them to the right places a lot of the time. So that's one.
Yeah.
Two. For years and years and years, we did not have solid structures for playing mysteries and role-playing games. So it was often on GMs to understand how mysteries work based on story structure, which is very rarely, if not ever, especially before 2006, which I'll get to that in a second, taught in role-playing game Dungeon Master guides. Mm-hmm. Like, we don't teach people how to run mysteries. We didn't do it really very well before that. At least I couldn't find it. And then they have to extrapolate that stuff, like how to do a mystery, into role-playing game mechanics and procedures. Fortunately, in 2006, a guy named Robin Laws, if you don't know who that is, I don't know what you're doing, listen to this, came up with a game called the Esoterists, which introduced the gumshoe system, which is like, cool, core clue. We're just going to give you the clue yep. and then do something with it, because that's way more interesting than anything we had before yeah. that, which we'll talk about other methodologies that exist yeah. later.
I do think that binary pass-fail assumption to a lot of game mechanics gets in the way of a lot of adventures, not just mysteries.
Yeah, that's point three. People think failure means don't give a clue. That's silly. Stop doing that. You never should have done that to begin with anyway. Think about it. As soon as you block the progress of the mystery, you've killed the pace, assuming there's nowhere else for the players to go look next as their characters. But like, if you're think of clues as locked doors. Uh-huh. Like if there's only one way to go down the passageway and that door is locked and you can't pick the lock, then the mm-hmm. adventure just stops.
It brings me back to the 1980s and playing, and we can't pick a lock, and the GM's like, well, I guess we're done playing today. If you guys can't get through the door, the rest of the adventure's locked. Why?
Yeah, right? So imagine if you're a game master from like the 90s that didn't understand any of this stuff and you just followed these three things, which is what generally role-playing games did for us. Like, don't run railroads, failure means you don't move forward, and we're not going to tell you how to do this. You're in a lot of trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's my three reasons, and those are the roadblocks that are there because of that.
I also have something else to add to that, that most GMs that really want to create a mystery, it is because they saw a movie, they read a book about a mystery that is so good, they wanted to do something like that themselves. But there is one main difference when you are listening, watching whichever media you're doing that mystery, or running the game, in which you don't control the players. The players are on their own, trying to do their own thing. When you are writing a mystery on a book, you control the main character, so you can make them reach the clue, deduct what you want them to deduct, and tell the reader whatever it needs to receive. Whereas when you are on your own game, you leave a clue there for the players to grab on, and they grab the piece of paper with maybe it has some clue on the murder weapon, but maybe they don't make that sort of assimilation there, and that's when the game walks into a halt, because you are expecting too much out of the players, and you should give enough clues for them to do the whole triangulation there. There's an amazing article right there on the Alexandrian that is very popular, that is the three clues mystery, I think it was the name.
Yeah, I'll get into that. The three clue, like you put the clue in three different places.
You go ahead.
Talking about? Yeah, well, no, I can talk about it if you want. Yeah, we can talk about it right now. I do want to talk about the thing that you just said, though. As the game master, like, you provide a clue, the players start doing something with it. You talked about, as the writer, like, you can set up the ending and then have your characters do things along the way. As game masters, we don't have a lot of control over what the players are doing. But just because you gave them one clue, as long as they choose to do something with it, you have the power to give them other clues and more information to point them in certain directions. You just keep feeding them information until they get on the right track, as long as they keep doing things.
The key word here is context.
Yeah, context matters a lot.
You need to give your players the context of a clue. You can give them the actual clue, but if they don't figure out the context, and this is where the whole you and the players may not be on the same page about what you think is obvious. This is where you help give them the context of a clue so they can start being closer to the page you are on.
And if you want to do that in character, in game, you just give them the context from the point of view of their character's competencies.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's important to know what the characters of the players can actually do. So, like, if they find something with, like, you know, blood on it, and there's a forensic police officer there, they can actually take it to a lab and analyze it. Like, you're like, hey man, you're a forensic police officer. Like, you would know that you would just take this to a lab and get it analyzed, and then you can provide more information based on that character's thing.
I do this all the time where, like, you know, you find some clue that has some historical relevance to the person that has the history, you know, the skill related to that. So you would know blah, 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 you know, like all the stuff about that. Mm-hmm. That could end up being relevant to this mystery.
We call that respecting the competency of the character.
Yes.
Three clue system. That was the next
one. Go ahead.
I know we'll talk about some of the stuff later, but the idea, the base idea is that when you are going to have a clue that's important, you make sure that you have that clue in three different places to be found, so that if they fail once or even twice, there's still a third place that they can acquire the clue and then move on to the next thing. It is not my favorite thing to do, because I'm just a kind of a, like, let me just give you the clue and put a timer on a thing to make it harder on you, like, and put pressure on you. But in that old school kind of play where, like, pass failure is a thing and, you know, it's all about, like, being clever and whatnot, that actually works a little bit better for mysteries, I think.
I think it's a good transitional skill to develop. If you are only used to running more traditional adventures and stuff, and you want to try your hand at a mystery, that can be a good way to branch into it. But I think if you get more experience and you start looking at some other games that are designed to run mysteries, you realize it's like, it is clearly in this spot, or this spot. You have the clue, you know about where they'll find it, and you adapt to where the players are looking and investigating and slide the clue in for them, as long as it makes sense for everything. That makes sense?
It does. I'm looking at Alexandrian's three.
Yeah, I think it was different from what you were saying. I have a different memory of it. In it being that you lay out different clues in there, but as long as players get three clues to all lead to understanding one specific thing, three clues should be enough for them to make the connection. One clue may not be enough. Two may be enough for those who are clever enough to figure it out, but three is like the obvious solution for them to just picture out what the clues are trying to define. That's what I remember was it. Maybe I'm mistaken there.
I can read a chunk of it.
Go ahead.
Whenever you're designing a mystery, you should invariably follow the three clue rule. For any conclusion you want the PCs to make, include at least three clues. And why three? Because the PCs will probably miss the first, ignore the second, and misinterpret the third before making some incredible leap of logic that will get them where you wanted them to go all along. I mean, he's joking, of course, right?
He's not wrong.
I think he developed it based on the thing that I said, or people interpreted that thing that I said. But yeah, it's about, they should be able to use at least one of these clues to reach the right conclusion and keep the adventure moving. A modification of it is putting the same clue in three different spots. So like if they miss any of those spots, you can just give it to them and then avoid a familiar place. But yeah, it's about three clues, like you said, that will lead at least to the next thing. So yeah, that if they at least get one of them, they can move along. If they get two of them, it'll be reinforcement to putting them to the next place. Mm-hmm.
So let's move on. And like we've talked about how hard running mysteries can be. Why do we enjoy doing it? Chris, I'll start with you this time.
Sure. I hated running mysteries for a long time because I didn't see any structure and I hadn't done the work to figure out how they worked because, you know, I didn't get my degree in creative writing and then keep studying story structure until I was like 30. So up until I was 30, I'm like, this is stupid. It doesn't make any sense. But nowadays, we have lots of support for how this stuff works and a variety of different potential play styles for things so that I've been able to like find variety in my mysteries, which is important to me. So that's why I enjoy it. There's like a bunch of different mystery structures that I can apply to my role-playing games, from The Onion, The Trail of Clues, The Three Clue Method, Attaching a Timer, The Primary-Secondary Clue Method, The Brindlewood Bayes Clue System. All these tools help me put together mysteries that can all play differently, and I'm sure that I'm missing some from somewhere.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. What about you, Tomas? Why do you enjoy running mysteries?
As for me, I am all into that aha moment. When players react and notice that one clue is enough for them to just understand what really is going on, and then all the pieces start to come together and one jumps up with one idea of what is going on and the other one reacts, oh, that's why that was going on at the other place, and that's why the first guy started to talk with us, and that collaborative idea brainstorming starts to appear and they all lead into, oh, okay, so the bad guy must be this guy or something like that, and they know at that moment what is going on, and then you abruptly end the session there for them to know that they have to wait a long whole week until they can make whatever they planned. I absolutely love that moment. That's why I live for mysteries and why I love running them. As for me, I know many of these mystery methods that Chris was saying, and they are all fantastic. By the way, I really like as well the Brindlewood system. I haven't tried it out yet, but the fact that you as a GM don't even know the answer to the mystery and everyone at the table comes up with the answer for the mystery on the spot and decides what the best solution may be out of the clues that they randomly found is majestic, in my opinion.
Man, it feels so good. I've ran two full campaigns of public access. Something like 70 hours of play in that game. Like,
wow.
It's really satisfying to watch those people put that thing together and listen to them talk about it. It's really enjoyable.
Yeah, I can imagine. And one other thing that I wanted to mention and stand out for me on running mysteries, the game that I have enjoyed the most playing and running that is very much themed around running a mystery is City of Mist. This is a game that I absolutely love. Starting with the art style, it is incredible. But then the way that it manages the tension, the way that it manages mysteries per se, is sublime. And there's a whole section in the back of it that is the GM section that I always recommend to players or people that want to run a mystery, which is the iceberg system, in which you start with one specific hook and then you lead to many different possible results, and these all results lead to other places or people, and these lead to others, but they all start opening up at first into like 5-6 different places, then they go into 4 places and locations, then you lead into one clue and one person, for example, and this all, once you go through any of those different paths with your players, you end up with one possible outcome, and that's the solution to the mystery. If you do have a City of Mist or can get your hands on this book, really, I recommend you to go and check out the GM section. It has changed my viewpoint of how a mystery works, absolutely.
It's also a very pretty book.
Yes.
You can also kill somebody with it as a Power by the Apocalypse game. Like, it is the biggest book I've ever seen. That I ran like a 2-shot with City of Mist, and I'm like, it's one of those games I wish I had run a campaign of. I remember that the investigate move from that game also like influenced greatly how I thought about distributing clues and whatnot, because it's here, have some basically hold, which are clues to ask questions to people and they have to tell you the truth. I'm like, oh, that's great. Like, it doesn't even feel like I'm giving you a clue. It feels like you're fishing for the clue that I want, that I'm going to give you anyway. It's fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
That book is why I switched to reading on my iPad. Because it nearly gave me a concussion when I started dozing off while reading it.
That makes sense, yes.
It does.
It's a large book.
It is, but the rules are very simple, so don't be intimidated by it if you are a listener.
Yeah, it's...
Isn't it mostly setting?
It's mostly setting, yes.
It's definitely a lot of atmosphere.
Yes.
Definitely got a very specific atmosphere to it.
Mm-hmm. Very much like The Wolf Among Us, if you have played the Telltale game.
Yeah, man. It's so good.
If you like that, this is for you.
Read Fables, like probably that same shtick a little bit.
Fables.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I've got those on my, I've got those graphic novels over on my shelf right now.
Those are great, yes.
Yeah.
I love hanging out with nerds. It's so much fun to talk about stuff that we all like.
And adding up on that sort of element that Chris was mentioning before, the clues method of the investigate system, just to more or less define how it works in better detail, is that whenever the players do that move and they roll well enough, they get like a meta currency in which they can at any point ask you as a GM a direct question and you have to reply with the truth. But the thing that is interesting about that is that you can be vague with your answer. Even if they decide to say, hey, who is the murderer on this case? You won't give them the answer because that'll ruin the whole case. But you can say, you find that in the corpse there is a note that may lead you to whoever must have done this. And you describe how the note looks or something like that. And that's something that is very unique and really makes it easy, even for new players in the hobby, to understand how to roleplay this element of investigation.
Let's move into talking about advice on how to run mysteries. Chris, you were going to say something there?
Sure. If we're going to talk about advice about how to run mysteries, let's just talk about that particular game and Powered by the Apocalypse games for a second. Context matters a ton, so fictional positioning means a lot in that game, which is the concept that Tomas is getting at. Fictional positioning in that situation would allow you to find that note on that corpse, and the game master can't just like necessarily tell you information. They have to give you information based on what's happening around the scene.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
There's some advice for you. Understand fictional positioning and make sure the context of a situation matters for what's happening with dice rolls.
I will also go back to something Chris said earlier. Respect the competency of the characters.
Sure.
Yes.
I've seen this happen in way too many games where the player is struggling to figure something out, but the character is an expert in a particular field or a particular discipline, and help them along. Point out to them what their character would know. Give them that context for the clue that their character would have.
Mm-hmm. I'm playing a person with a PhD in anthropology because I don't have a PhD in anthropology. just throwing that out there.
Yeah, if you're playing a medic and you want to know how long ago the character died in front there, and you're just registering the corpse, you as a GM should let the medic know just by being close to the corpse how long ago this guy died.
It's a better example than mine. Good job. I failed there.
We mentioned before the gumshoe system, and the philosophy behind that system is that you never prevent the players and their characters from getting the clues. Mm-hmm. What their skills do is give them more context for what that clue means. And there's a whole economy related to their skills and the number of points they have in a particular skill that they can spend to get more information. Mm-hmm. But just take that whole concept of never prevent your players from getting the clues and put it in almost any game you're running a mystery.
Yeah.
It's like they will get the clue. What their role is going to mean is how much more context they get out of that clue.
But Ange, then it's just like me giving clues and there's not really any game. Well, then fine. Put a timer on the mystery so that there's some tension.
Absolutely, yeah. Have an assassin appear.
And honestly, don't lock your adventure behind a door. Whether that door is an actual physical door that your rogue can't pick the lock on, or it's a clue that they can't find because the GM hid it in the vent of the lady's bathroom, and we never said in an hour and a half that we looked in the vent in the lady's bathroom. I'm not speaking from personal experience or anything.
I feel like she is. That might have happened to her. We should probably run Tomas before she throws us in the stew pot just out of spite. We didn't do it, Ange. Stop looking at us like that. We're not dinner. Anyway, I was serious about the putting a timer and tension on the mystery. Like Tomas said, at some point, like two segments passes, an assassin appears. If like seven segments of like investigating pass, like the murderer gets away with it, right?
Yeah.
Like you figure out who it is, but they're gone. You're never catching them. They're in a different country.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, you could even do just something like they can't stay in the location where they're searching because there's people about to show up. The cops are going to show up. There's a bomb about to go, you know, like whatever it is, they can't stay there. They need to get the clues and get out.
Absolutely.
You know, you can add tension in a whole bunch of different ways.
Yep. Short term, medium term, long term.
Yeah. This
reactions
doesn't only apply to mysteries. You should almost always grab something to create that level of tension and that countdown.
Mm-hmm.
The world is moving. It's not waiting for you to do stuff. So that counter, even if it's not like something is about to go on that the players know, maybe you can give the sense of, okay, 10 minutes pass as you keep looking for this, and then you say later 20 minutes pass as you keep doing that, and that small detail that you're clarifying them, just because you're mentioning it, they will start to doubt if something is about to go off, and they will move quicker.
Dude, one of my favorite things to do in a role-playing game when people are like investigating a scene is, cool, you can investigate this area, but it's going to take you like an hour to really go over it.
Yes.
And they're like, but I want to do it faster. I'm like, all right, well, the DC's 10 higher then, right? Because you're only giving it a quick look for the things that you're looking for. And sure, I'll give you the mm-hmm. clue, but you probably won't get the context that you're looking for from that clue.
One of the other pieces of advice I'll give is, you know, there are certain games where you don't need to have the whole thing in, you know, written in stone ahead of time. But I find for a lot of the games I run, I need to know what happened, who did it, what the pertinent details of it are. I don't necessarily have to know how the players are going to solve this, but I need to know what happened that they are investigating so that I know where I can give them clues when they're investigating something. Now, as we've talked about with Brindlewood Bay and Public Access, there are games where that's not quite as much a part of the game. But in other types of games, I find that really helps me.
We call that a what's going on document. If you've ever read anything by other gnome, Phil Vecchione, he'll talk about those all day. He loves a what's going on document because he loves them. I've come to love them.
I usually have in my personal notes for the adventures I've written, I usually have a what's really going on, because I have the inciting incident that basically gets the character set on the investigation. And then I have the what's really going on. And then I have some ideas for clues and locations that they can go to. And then I just roll with whatever the players lean into.
Yeah, and something else that I wanted to add as well with all the different details that we are pointing is that even if you want to run a mystery, not every single game is the best for running a mystery. There are games that don't do as much of a good job at doing it. As much as I have run lots of mysteries in D&D or similar games, those are systems that are not tailor-made for mysteries and may have things that go against you, especially if you are a beginner at GMing. For example, if you are doing a murder mystery in something like D&D, a cleric may go up to the corpse and say and ask them, "Who killed you?" And the corpse will just spill the answer and spoil the whole fun. So be prepared for that.
You can get around that, though.
You can. There are many ways.
They didn't see who killed them.
Exactly.
It came from behind. They were poisoned. You know, it's like...
maybe there's an illusion going on.
Every time you introduce magic into a game, the murderer or the person that commits the crime has to do an extra level of thought in order to get around it. Now,
yeah,
that means you as a game master might have to do an extra level of thought so that you're just not denying the characters their competency. Like, if you're a wizard or a cleric and like you use those spells, that's some level of competency that you might be denying them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to Andrew's point, you just have to think about how to get around that stuff as far as like, I'm going to give you a clue. I'm not going to give you the answer.
Yeah.
Tomas is right. There are definitely games that are better to run mysteries in. I don't think this is necessarily a never have a mystery.
Absolutely.
In your D&D game, never have a mystery in your Savage Worlds game. It's more just be aware that the mechanics of the game are not necessarily designed to support a mystery.
It's because they don't have any structures for it.
Yeah, it's not the structure for it. It's a game for going out and punching monsters in the face. And you can do a lot in it, but it's not necessarily designed for a specific type of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the characters might not be as competent at solving them, or they're too generalized, right? Or they're too focused towards one thing and generalized towards other things. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of stuff with it.
Yeah.
I think, though, it's about the level of work that you want to put in to making a game work for that genre. You said D&D specifically, and I mean, I play all sorts of games, right? So if I had never played any other games and I tried to run a mystery in D&D, I'd probably fail. But because I've played all these other games and I can bring these different like ideas and systems and structures mostly to it, it's a lot easier. Like if we just do some of the stuff that we talked about, like put a timer on it. Failure doesn't mean that you don't get the clue on a skill check, on an ability roll. Failure means that something happens, like the timer accelerates faster or a complication occurs. But there's nowhere in a D&D book that says that.
Yeah.
You have to go figure that stuff out yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And that's for any game. Savage Worlds, same deal, really. I think Savage Worlds there's so many Savage Worlds books. I don't play that game enough or read enough about it that it's hard for me to talk about it.
Yeah, there's different settings that lean into mysteries more often. But at the same time, it still is a little more action-oriented.
You know what game doesn't do mysteries really well? Dungeon World. Like, I can hardly even begin to like conceive. It'd be so much more difficult to do it in that game, right? I'd have to like invent a move for it, which is like work. That's work.
Yeah.
But I get your point. Some games are just more suited for it out of the box.
Exactly.
Let's move on to talking about games that are specifically designed for running mysteries. We've mentioned a whole bunch of them.
Yeah.
Such as Public Access, Brindlewood Bay, Knights Black Agents, Vason, Tales from the Loop. Oh, which one do you want to talk about specifically, Ange? Sorry.
No, I think all of them are, you know, a lot of these games are definitely designed to support the idea of mysteries better. I have run a lot of Vason, or Vason, depending on how you pronounce it, and Tales from the Loop. Vason is 1800s investigations of supernatural. And the game sets it up so it's not just a monster hunting scenario. You're not just like, oh, there's a supernatural monster causing problems. We need to go hunt it down and kill it. It's, there's a supernatural thing causing problems, and you need to find out what caused it to start interacting with society and figure out what you need to do to stop it, because it's never just a monster mystery. There's usually a human that did something or humans that have done something that you need to figure out what happened there to cause things to go out of control and cause this conflict between the supernatural and the mundane world.
That game is about monster hunting and a clash of cultures.
Yeah.
Pretty much every mystery I've ever read about it is basically some sort of, like, we don't get along because we are from different cultural points of view. It's interesting.
See, I haven't really run into that with Vaisen. Of course, I've only run one of the published adventures. And everything I've put together has leaned into the idea that, yes, there is a supernatural thing causing a problem. Sometimes it's evil, sometimes it's not, but there is always people involved that exacerbated the problem or caused the problem to start with.
Yeah, because they don't get when it's the monster's not necessarily evil and it's just a person that's out there doing their own thing. It's all about a misunderstanding between two cultures. It's very, very interesting that it has that opinion, that game has that opinion.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
One other game that goes in a similar vein to that is Candela Obscura, that deals with all the supernatural and the veil of the things that people can comprehend and cannot. Leaning a bit as well with the whole Lovecraftian nature of the monsters and the unknown, which is very interesting. I happened to play in an actual play recently game. Similar to Blades in the Dark, it's similar to Vaisen in some aspects. It does the mystery in a different vein. I don't recommend it if you want to go very deep into the mystery. It's more of going and hunting it. Now, if you want to lean more into something like the Supernatural TV series, for example, and go and find the clues to find the monster or supernatural being, I do recommend Monster of the Week as well.
It's a good game.
I was just thinking, regardless of what you say, Tomas, I'm going to talk about Monster of the Week there.
Yes, go ahead, please.
No, Monster of the Week is interesting because a lot of times it's a very much more of a monster bad, need to get rid of monster. But the investigation often involves figuring out how you actually do that, because it is rarely a just shoot it in the face situation that you can solve.
Yeah, man, those monster sheets that you build out, the threat, they're really good at like providing that sort of like what's going on and what do the players need to figure out to solve the problem thing.
Yeah.
Any of the Gumshoe games are pretty fantastic for running mysteries.
We talked about the Trail of Clues idea. It's like you give a clue when they investigate a scene. You give extra clues or context to the clues if they spend points. It's a resource management game on the top of that. And then there's the other side. The characters are two-sided. They have essentially general skills, which are for like doing things, like action-y type things, because you're basically Jason Bourne vampire killers.
That's Nice Black Agents.
Yeah.
Not all of it. Like, I also have
Trail
Bubblegum Shoe.
Bubblegum Shoe is the teens
solving mysteries.
Teens, yeah. I haven't read that one, so I don't know exactly how they have it broken down.
Time Agents? That's the one where you're basically, you have some sort of thing that has gone awry and you need to go back in time and fix something that has gone amiss in history. And also Mutant City Blues is another Gumshoe System one.
Esoterisphere itself. I mean, the Gain Reach. There's a ton of them, right?
Yeah.
Swords of the Serpentine if you want
Sword and Sorcery.
Yep. Oh, man. Ashen Stars.
Time Watch.
Time Watch. Why isn't that on this list?
Then going with the Brindle Bay that we have talked about before, there's also Paranormal Inc., which is pretty much Scooby-Doo, using the same rules as Brindle Bay, which is pretty fun.
Yeah, Public Access, the podcast one. I always get confused with Old Gods of Appalachia and then the Magnus Archives, but those are both Monty Cook games.
Oh, yeah.
But there's the other one where you're basically wandering around as the avatar, as like the people of like old of terrible gods in a world that's not our own. there's a great podcast that they made. They made a bunch of money off that Kickstarter, The Gauntlet.
Man, they did, yes.
I can't remember what the name of that game is, though. Man, bad at this game. I'm bad at this game today.
Any last thing you want to say about mysteries?
They're super fun.
They are, yes. And one additional thing, we have sort of covered it beforehand, but don't be scared to read the whole rules about these games of mysteries and grabbing the rules you like and putting them into the games that you are playing at the moment. I have run games of D&D with the rules for Investigation of City of Mist, as well as the Gumshoe system just implemented in there. indicating that whenever you need to find a clue, you will find it. Those work as well for Apocalypse World, those work as well for any other game you are playing. In fact, I have run as well Kids on Brooms games that are more or less Harry Potter-esque games, and I have run mysteries in there as well, grabbing things from those games and putting it in there. It's as simple as that.
Yeah, I was going to say, if there's one thing you take away from this episode, take a look at these concepts and put them in any game you're running that you're trying to do a mystery in.
The Silt Versus. That's the name of the game. The Silt Versus. Ghost of El Paso, too.
Any last words, Chris? Or are those your last words?
A City of Mists investigative rule on a D&D game sounds brilliant. I don't know why I didn't think of it. Thank you for that idea.
It works great.
That's my last word.
This show is funded by the Gnome Stew Patreon. You too can Patreon back by following the Patreon link on the Gnome Stew website to the Gnome Stew Patreon. We love doing this, and our patrons help us keep it going. The Gnomecast is part of the Polygamers Podcast Network, so if you're enjoying us, here's another show you should check out.
You know, Ange, I told you that you could just say that at a normal speed, and I'll speed it up for you in the edit. But, you know, if you want to keep just rifling it off like the micro cars guy, then you can. Anybody remembers that old commercial? Anyways, Panda's Talking Games. Charming longtime gamers talking about tabletop role-playing games and making outtakes. Join Panda's Phil and Senda every other Wednesday, answering listener questions about playing, running, and designing TTRPGs. It's like car talk, but for your games.
You can find all of us at GnomeStew.com, along with GnomeStew on Facebook, Blue Sky, Instagram, Meta. It's an interesting world out there, but we're out there. Is there anything else you'd like to give a shout-out to today?
Yes, for my part, I want to give a shout out to a crowdfunding campaign that is starting in a few days, which is from a friend of mine. This project is called Xeno, as in Xenomorph, which you play as the alien that has to kill the people in some facility or wherever you are. It's a very rules-light game, and you just have to massacre people and feel great about it. Especially in this time and age in which you may want to just give out some punches. Let's say. That's for my part.
So is that like a one-on-one game? Is it like a board game?
No, it's you can play with many players. You play many Xenomorphs and you go into facility. It was born out of a one-page game in which you have the rules in both sides of one page. But right now it's going on a crowdfunding campaign, and they are like expanding the whole progress. It's from Cali Guys.
We're all gonna die, man. We're all gonna die.
Game over, man. Game over for Aliens 2 out there, or Aliens, I should just say. It's not got a 2 on the end of it. My bad. Ange, what about you?
So I am loading up on maps for my upcoming Tales of the Valiant campaign I'm running, and I stumbled across Afternoon Maps, and I fell in love. Their maps really suit a style I enjoy with bright, colorful, interesting watercolor style. It is a Patreon, so it does require support to access the maps, but you can browse through and see if it's worth it for you. There'll be a link in the show notes.
For me, it's Brandon Sanderson's Writing Lecture Series 2025. So Brandon Sanderson, if you don't know, he's a famous sci-fi and fantasy author. I don't know how you don't know. Just look at the Cosmere role-playing game people. But he does these and records them at Brigham Young University pretty much every year. And I think it's a great free resource to learn a lot about story structure from one of the most prominent writers of sci-fi and fantasy in the world. And I believe that people should like listen to stuff like this and check things like this out, because at some point as a GM, it's really hard to learn novel or new things from role-playing games to be a better game master. And I think that you need to start going outside of role-playing games to understand things like character, story, situation, plot, camera angles, table management, soft skills, organization, improvising both short and long form, point of view, and a bunch of other things. Like, the list goes on for game mastering skills. The art of game mastering is hard. And I think that this lecture series is a good place to start expanding your viewpoint and then figuring out how to bring that back to your table.
Awesome. So, do you all think this episode... Oh, no! There's already a body in the stew! Who is it?
Me, of course. My old me, anyway. Please don't put me in there. I can see that it hurts.
Is it?
Me, of course. My old me, anyway. Please don't put me in there. I can see that it hurts.